Morning. My name is Priscilla, and I'm a very grateful member of this Fellowship of Al-Anon. And I've had a wonderful time. I've received so many blessings this weekend, and I'm not even part of your zone. And I don't know. You've allowed me to participate and do things I never dreamed I was going to be doing 3 weeks ago. But anyway, I'm really glad to be here. And your speaker this morning, Bobby S. from Charleston. I don't know if she was in the very first meeting I walked into, because I don't remember a lot about that, but Bobby has been part of my life from just about from the beginning. She wouldn't know what to do if I didn't have tears. She has sat at my kitchen table and grieved with me. I have sat in her living room and grieved with her. We're just really close, and we've grown, and she's now a very, very special friend. And I love her very much. Bobby. Gosh, what beautiful people. First time I've been up here. My name is Bobby Strange, and I am a grateful recovering member of Al-Anon. By God's grace, I was able to find this program of recovery. Not that I needed it, you know. I walked in the door almost 20 years ago just to get my husband sober. And here I am today with a whole different attitude of gratitude. And I think that's one of the greatest gifts that I've received since I have been here, is the ability to be grateful. And as my story unfolds, maybe you can understand a little bit about that. In 1953, almost to the day, was a very, very special day for me. I got married. And my dreams were all coming true. I was marrying my knight in shining armor, who wore a Citadel uniform. And he was not an alcoholic, because I had made up my mind that I would never go out with anybody who drank, and I certainly wouldn't marry anybody who did. So we were going to live happily ever after. And for about 10 years, we did. I had this imaginary mold in my head of a wife and a husband and children. I had a girl mold and a boy mold. And I had a boy who fit the mold a year after we got married. And then 6 years later, we had a little girl that fit the girl mold. And we were very, very happy. Everything was perfect. You see, I had made every decision I ever made growing up was based on growing up in alcoholism. I was born into a very, very strict, religious, Southern Baptist home. And I don't mean to offend anybody, but I'm also a recovering Southern Baptist, and I found that in Al-Anon. A long line of ministers and drunks. And the men that I loved in my life just happened to be the alcoholics. My grandfather was an adorable, sweetest thing you ever met in your life. But people used to say he's just a sorry drunk. And then my father drank 3 months out of the year. He was a farmer. When he finished his crops, he started drinking. After he sold his tobacco in the fall, and he drank until the first of the year when it was time to plant tobacco beds again. And those 3 months, which were all around the holidays, brought so much pain to us. And I really despised my mother. I loved her, but I despised her because she would not stand up to him. And I used to think, when I grow up, I am not going to allow any man to do this to me. You know, he is going to be home for dinner and blah, blah, blah. And the one thing my mother used to say, don't ever say what you're never going to do, because that's what you always end up doing. But I used to say, Mama, why don't you leave him? And she said, I can't. My tail is too long. And I didn't understand what she meant, but finally she told me one day she didn't have a formal education. And she couldn't make a living for herself, so she was dependent on my father. And I made a decision right then and there. I'm going to get an education, and I'm going to be able to take care of myself, regardless, you know, even though I'm not going to marry an alcoholic, just in case, I'm going to take care of myself. And that's what I did. I went to nursing school, and I graduated. I became a registered professional nurse. But I wasn't going to work because I was going to marry that perfect person. I was just going to have that as sort of a backup, just in case, like an insurance policy. And so we moved to, well, first I need to tell you that my mother died when she was 41, just about a year after I got married, maybe 2 years after I got married because I had a child. And I believe my mother died from the disease of alcoholism, and she never had a drink. She did not have the will to live. She just didn't. And that made me even harder, feel harder toward my father. But my father got sober. By the grace of a loving Heavenly Father, he got sober. But it was not in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think we'd heard of Alcoholics Anonymous then. It was about 1954, I guess. Just before my mother died, he got sober. And he had a true spiritual awakening. So this reinforced to me that alcoholics were bad people. And when he was saved, he became a good person. So it just reinforced what I've been hearing from my religious upbringing, that it was a sin. And my father and I did become friends. But here I am in this perfect marriage, and I did go to work, by the way, because my drug, I guess I'm an addict, and my drug of choice is adrenaline. I just love being a nurse. I just love being in charge, and I just love all the excitement. And so I started spending more and more time at work, and I started climbing the corporate ladder, and I became assistant director of nurses at the Medical University in Charleston not too long after we moved there. And about 10 years after we got married, my husband had never had a drink. And all of a sudden, he started having a drink with his friends at the office in the afternoons. And you know, at first, when he first started drinking, it was fun. Because he would do things on the spur of the moment, you know, like call me Friday afternoon at 5:30 and say, you want to go to Florida for the weekend? Get the kids packed up. So away we'd go and spend the weekend with relatives or friends. And then I remember one time he gave me like 3 days notice that we were going to take a trip to Hawaii. And I had to get all of my nursing areas scheduled and everything in order, and I nearly worked myself to death. I stayed in bed the first 3 days we were in Hawaii because I was exhausted. But I love that. You know, that was exciting. And I cannot tell you when it crossed over. They say in our literature, it says that alcoholism is a slow disease. And I've heard it said that the chains of alcoholism are so soft that you can't feel them until they're too strong to break. And that's exactly what happened. I was in this, and I didn't know how to get out. Even though I could take care of myself, my tail was too long, and I didn't understand it. I didn't understand why. And people used to say, why don't you leave him? Why don't you leave him? Why didn't I leave him? You know, I think back, if he had been one of these loving, happy drunks like my grandfather, I probably wouldn't be standing here today. Because there was nothing wrong with me. I was just about as perfect as you can be, you know. I really was. I was a good mother. I was a good nurse. I tried to be a good wife. I was a good housekeeper. I was a great cook. And I joined the Presbyterian Church with my husband, and I had my children shined up and in Sunday school every Sunday morning. And I had the biggest resentment on my way to church because when I left to go to church, he left to go to the Elks Club to drink. And I was so angry, I never heard a thing the preacher said. I started working in the nursery so I wouldn't have to listen to that stuff, you know, because I didn't want to hear it. And somewhere along the way, God was, I was angry, just so angry with him, because I thought if that God I used to hear about loved me, I wouldn't suffer like this. It was very painful. I didn't come in here feeling good about myself. My self-esteem was under the rug. My husband was verbally abusive, and yet he was a loving, wonderful person. Arbutus talked about two people, and that's who I live with, two people. In the evening, when he came home, or whenever he came home, very angry and very verbally abusive to the oldest child and me. And then the next morning, he was the sweetest, kindest, loving, most gentle husband and father. Of course, I went to work at 5:30 in the morning, so I very seldom ever saw that side of it. But he always got up and made breakfast for the children. I don't care what time he got home or what time, how hungover he was. He always got up and made breakfast for them. I did almost everything I could think of to try to get this man sober. Everything I could think of. I even went to my minister and asked him for advice because we'd been a psychiatrist. I had drugged him everywhere. I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous. And so my minister said, why don't you try reverse psychology and go out and buy you a beautiful new negligee? Because by this time, you know, there weren't any clothes for me. I didn't think I deserved them or whatever. And have your hair done, get you some new perfume, and get yourself all fixed up. And when he comes home, instead of screaming and yelling at him or throwing things, which I was a physical abuser. I used to throw things at him all the time. And just open the door and tell him you love him. So I thought, oh, God. But I'll try. You know, I'm game. I'll try anything. And so I went out and I paid like back then like $100 for this gorgeous outfit. And I looked beautiful. And after the children went to bed, I started putting on my makeup and getting ready and doing the perfume, you know, and spraying the room and everything. And, of course, I had to redo it about four times because it must have been 2 o'clock when he came in. And I could always tell how much he'd had to drink by how long it took him to get from the car to the door and to get that key in the door. And he was trying to open the door. And I opened it for him, and I smiled, and I said, come on in, honey, and give me a kiss. And he looked at me like he had never seen me before in his life. And he said, I might as well. I'm a catch hell when I get home anyhow. You cannot get up early enough to outthink an alcoholic. So don't even go there. You know, don't even try. They always one up on you. About the time that this was going on, we had a third child. And guess what? He did not fit the mold. Oh, my Lord. Here I am with my hands full of being a nursing administrator, being the wife of a drunk, being the wife of the mother of two perfect children, and then this thing comes along. He was beautiful. My other two children were dark. I used to have dark hair, by the way. This child had the most beautiful blonde hair you have ever seen in your life, and the deepest dimples and the bluest eyes. And at first, I thought they gave me the wrong baby. And at that time, I was OB supervisor. And I even, later on, checked the delivery log that day to be sure that there wasn't another male born. Because he was so different. He was hyperactive. He cried a lot. He had temper tantrums. Oh, what a nightmare. And I was in no emotional state to take care of this child. I took him to every psychiatrist. He changed schools every semester. I sent him to every school, private school in Charleston except Port-au-Gaud. And that's where my oldest son went, and I didn't want him to ruin his reputation. This kid was a nightmare. When he was about 13 years old, his daddy's drinking first of all, when he was little, he used to read my mind. Literally, this child could read my mind and know exactly what I was thinking. I used to have some really bad thoughts. You know, I was such a good person, and I never said bad words, but I sure thought them. And Ken was sitting in his high chair one evening. I always got him all shined up for dinner, you know, just in case he came home on time. And sure enough, this day, everything was ready. And I was putting food on the table, and the children were perfect. And this gorgeous little cherub was sitting in his high chair. And his daddy came in, and he loved this child. I mean, they bonded from the very beginning because they were just alike. And so he kissed him, and he fixed a drink, and then he went in and sat down with his drink. And we communicated through our daughter, the middle child. I said, "Carolyn, please go tell your daddy to come in. Let's have dinner." So the third time I said this, this child in that high chair said, "Oh, let that old son of a bitch sit in there and read his paper. I'm ready to eat." About as spiritual as I can be, y'all. And you know, where'd he get it from? My husband was an alcoholic, but he did not swear. He didn't say ugly words. I mean, there were a lot of positive things about him, really, you know, when I look back on it. But I got sicker and sicker, and I had a new mission. I had this child that I had to control, two of them. You know, I don't know, there were not enough hours in the day. I got by on 3 hours of sleep a night. This child was about 13. He discovered pot, and he loved it. And then he started drinking. I wasn't aware of that at first, and I wasn't aware of any of it, except that his behavior improved. And so I wasn't aware that he was having something to fix it, you know. But I just got sicker and sicker. I got crazy. I really did. And when he was about 14 or 15, I tried one more time to get my husband sober. And he had a cousin, Russell S., that some of you might know. He has about 51 years of sobriety now. And I remembered one night, you know, just like a light bulb came on. His cousin is in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I called the next morning to ask them if they would send somebody over to talk to him, or either send him over to take him to a meeting. And they told me they didn't do that, that he had to want to go, or he had to call himself, that they weren't going to come over and rescue him. But somehow this person that answered the phone felt like I needed help. And I don't know why, but she said, he said, "I'm going to give you, give this woman your number and have her call you." And the lady that called me has been in AA for many, many years, and she's from North Carolina, and I adore her. I adore her, but she calls a spade. And she called me back, and after she listened to me for like 5 minutes, she said, "Let me tell you one thing, honey. You can't do a damn thing about his drinking, but you can get your ass to Al-Anon." And I thought, "Oh, okay, I'll go." I said, "Where'd I find it?" And she told me it was 2 miles from my house. And I thought that Al-Anon was a group that families went to learn a magic formula for getting them sober. That's, you know, I think a lot of people still think that. Or either a place that you go and you talk about them. And I went to that meeting that night. She did tell me, she said, "Now you're going to have to go through a bunch of alcoholics in the front room. And then you're going to find your Al-Anon room in the back." So I went early, and I parked way down the street because I didn't want anybody to see my car. You know, who knew my car, for Lord's sake? I didn't want people to know. I was afraid I'd see somebody I knew. And I remember going through, you know how they stand outside and file and smoke? Well, all those men were standing out, and a few women were standing out there smoking. And I kind of closed my eyes and held my nose up in the air, you know, such a pseudo snob. And I thought, God, I hope none of those alcoholics touch me. And at this point, I've been sleeping with one for about 20 years. You know, that's where I was. And I went to that meeting, and I didn't hear the magic formula. But I heard a lot of laughter. I heard about gratitude. And when I heard that, I went, what do these people have to be grateful for? And the things that you laughed at were ridiculous. How could you laugh at something? Oh. And now, I wasn't judgmental at all. You understand that? But I did hear, keep coming back. If you don't hear what you need to hear, think you need to hear tonight, keep coming back 8 to 9 times. So I didn't hear the magic formula of how to get him sober, so I kept coming back. And that's the only reason. But something happened to me within that 8 to 9 times that I started feeling safe. I started feeling loved. I started feeling understood. I started feeling that I belonged. Really belonged somewhere for the very first time in my life. I belonged. And I kept going back. And before I knew it, I realized I was coming back for me. Not for him. But you know, my attitude at home started changing. And I stopped throwing things at him. I stopped picking a fight. If, you know, he came in, I quit yelling at him. And he got real suspicious. And he was reading my literature. You know, he'd read my literature, and then he'd say, if I slipped, had a little slip. Now, on page 3, chapter 4, it says that you should have compassion for the alcoholic. And so he called my hand on it all the time. And one night he followed me to a meeting, and he'd had a few too many. And I didn't know he'd ever tried to go to AA before, but he was familiar with the rooms. He had tried to get sober, and he couldn't. And he followed me to a meeting, and he came back in the back. And does everybody have anybody have an Al-Anon Nazi in their groups? You know, one of those old blue-haired women that I got a mind, I've got gray hair, blue-haired women that sit there, and if you mention something other than Cal, you know, she gives you a look that just melts, just petrifies you right there. Well, this woman he chose to lean over her shoulder when breathe that whiskey breath of hers is down her throat. I mean, yeah, down her throat, down her neck, and say, I hope y'all can do something with her because her drinking is driving me crazy. He thought it was a woman's AA group, and that's where he was. Finally, I've been in Al-Anon for about a year and a half, and about a year, and then my son got into trouble at school. And I had talked to him about Alateen. He got into trouble at school one day, and he called me. I was in a real important meeting, and he paged me, and for some reason I thought, I need to answer this page. And I answered the page, and he says, Mom, I saw my guidance counselor today, and she told me about an Alateen meeting, and it's at the same place where you go to your meetings, and I'm going to go Thursday night. Will you take me? And I just looked up and thought, thank God. He heard it from somebody else, but he couldn't hear it from me. And then he kept going to Alateen. He tells me today that I would take him to Alateen, and he'd go in the front door and go out the back and smoke a joint frequently. And he said, because I couldn't handle that pain. I couldn't handle what those kids were saying. But he went. And about a year and a half after I started going to Al-Anon and really started getting into my steps and working my program, my husband decided to get sober. He decided to go to a treatment center. And just to make a long story short, after he went out and talked with them, he decided to take 2 weeks off what he did was going to drink as much as he could drink in 2 weeks. And you know, it was so unacceptable at home, that behavior, that I knew that if I was going to keep my sanity, I had to leave. And I mentioned it one day. I said, we were coming back from a football game in Clemson, and he started drinking on the way and wouldn't let me drive and was so obnoxiously abusive. And I said to my son, I have to get out of this. I cannot live like this anymore. He says, oh, Mom, in Alateen, they tell us to say what you mean and mean what you say. And I have heard you say that 5,000 times, and you haven't taken any action yet. So out of the mouth of this Alateen, I heard what I needed to. I needed to take some action. And I went to work that morning. I told him that I was going the next morning, that I was going to leave. And I was, because I could not live in that situation. I was going to die. Between the two of them, I could not live any longer. And it's one of the hardest things I ever did, because I never intended to leave him. I didn't marry him to leave him. And I went to work that day, didn't know where I was going, but I knew that God was going to take care of me. And one of my friends called and said that right after I got to work and said he wanted to talk with me, he had just been diagnosed with cancer and wanted to ask me how he could tell his wife. And so when we finished sharing, we cried together, and I said, well, I have something to tell you. I ran away from home this morning. I don't know where I'm going. And he said, oh, well, we just moved in from the beach. Why don't you go out there? So for 3 wonderful months, I lived on the beach all by myself. I didn't cook a meal if I didn't want to. I didn't wash a dish if I didn't want to. I walked on the beach. I did exactly what I wanted to do. And finally, his sickness got so severe that he threatened, made a mistake of calling his psychiatrist, who was a very good friend of mine, in a blackout, I'm sure, and saying that he was going to kill himself and going to kill me. And so the doctor called me and said, you've got to have this man committed for his sake and for your sake. And that's the second hardest thing I ever did, because I really felt like I was taking away his rights. And so I marched those 3 children down to the judge's office, and we signed the papers, and we had him committed to a treatment center. And it was a nightmare, a nightmare. And he stayed angry with me a long time about that. But you know, my program was so strong that I could give him the right to be angry. And I told him one day, I said, I'm not going to talk about this anymore, but I want to tell you something. I would do the same thing all over again because I care that much about you. I didn't expect him to stay sober. You know, not this angry human being could never stay sober. But I had seen so many miracles that I knew there was a possibility. And he jumped into AA from that treatment center. He came home on New Year's Eve, and the first thing that happened is that he told me in the treatment center he wasn't going to drink anymore, so without consulting him, I emptied the bar. I just gave all the liquor away. He comes in, and he said, where is my booze? Did you drink it? Did you have a party while I was gone? I said, no. He said you weren't going to drink anymore, so I gave it away. I'd taken away his rights. I had no right to do that. So he went to the liquor store and bought 2 of everything and stocked that bar again. And I thought, oh, God, he is going to hang one on tonight. And when he got back, he said, oh, I forgot to tell you, they're having an Alcathon tonight. And everybody's going from AA, and would you like to go? And we went to that Alcathon that New Year's Eve. And that became one of the most important things in his life, is having that alkathon on New Year's Eve so people could have a good time. He believed in enjoying his sobriety, and he did. You know, the first year was not easy. We were both recovering, and we both, it's a miracle that we ever got our family together, got our lives together. But you know, we didn't work on the marriage. We worked on each other. And we had a very wise man that advised us, allow each other to recover. And that's exactly what we did. Bo was talking about giving Shirley the elbow. I literally had to sit on my hands at an open AA meeting to keep from nudging him every time somebody said what I thought he needed to hear. And we really had a wonderful life. To the point that I couldn't believe it. This child kept drinking more and was still living at home and didn't go to college. Felt real insecure, didn't feel as good about himself he did go to college, but he flunked out. And so when he was about 22 years old, I guess, my husband was speaking up in Spartanburg one day, and we went up, getting up early to drive up there, and I heard my son come in about 4 o'clock in the morning and go to bed, and we were dressing, we were both hurrying to dress, so I went in to use my son's bathroom, and I smelled that old stale odor of beer. And I thought, you know, I do not have to live this way. This is unacceptable. I don't have to smell that in my home. And so I prayed for the right words to say to my husband when we got in the car. I said, I told him how I felt. And he said, well, let's just pray for the right words to say to him when we get home. And let's don't let this ruin our day. We're going to have a wonderful day. I forgot about it. We got home that evening about 8:30, and my daughter was there, who is his second mother. And he, his eyes were this big, and he said, Mom, Dad, I need to talk with you. And you know, my first thought was, I wonder who's pregnant. And he sat us down and pulled his chair up between us, reached in his pocket and pulled out a white chip. Oh, these are tears of joy, okay? He said, I didn't know which way to turn. I hit my spiritual bottom last night. And said, this morning, after you guys left, he said, I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. And he said, I went to the priest, he was Episcopal, and talked with him. And he said, Ken, you know, your parents have paved the road for you. You know where to go. And he said he called. Excuse me. Called the number, AA. And he said, if they had given me that contact number, which was our number, he said, I would have died. But he went on in and picked up a white chip. So, you know, it's just a miracle. I started really getting into service work. I had a wonderful sponsor who made me get in the car and made me go to assembly, made me get involved at group level and state level, district level and state level. And I really started growing when I started getting into service work. When I started giving back what I'd been given, I remember that we were in a place that was almost too good to be true. We were having such a good time. We had a stronger marriage than we had ever had, a stronger relationship. And I was alternate delegate, and I was real excited about that. You know, I thought, what a wonderful way to serve Al-Anon, and what a wonderful experience. And we were in Willing Way Hospital, at Willing Way Homecoming in 1994. And, he died so unexpectedly, and some of you were there. He had heart arrhythmias, and they resuscitated him, but they got him to the emergency room, and then he died. And a man that he sponsors was with him, and he's a surgeon. And he went into the emergency room with him. And when he came out, he said, "Bobby, he saved my life, and I couldn't save his." But, you know, I was so grateful. I was overcome with gratitude because I was surrounded by people who loved me. You know, people had left the AA meeting. Rusty was speaking that morning. And you know what I thought later? Frank Strange would do anything to interrupt an Al-Anon meeting. but not really, you know. And so people had come from the meeting and were sitting there with me holding my hand. And they were making decisions for me and just helping me through this. It wasn't easy. We got home, and once again, my home was filled with members of AA and Al-Anon. And they stayed there. I have AA women friends who stayed with me. They wouldn't leave me. I had my Al-Anon friends who stayed with me. I remembered, in my despair, I remembered something that I heard early on in the meeting, where we always read, "You can learn to be happy whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not." And when I used to hear that at first, I just want to throw up, because I think, obviously, you don't live with the same alcoholic I live with. But I changed those words in my mind, that I can learn to be happy if the alcoholic is living or not. You know, I am a person. Al-Anon has given me myself. I can stand on my own two feet. And just about a week before he died, he said to me one day, "You know, probably the greatest thing you ever did was leave me and go to the beach for those 3 months." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because you know you can stand on your own two feet and you can be alone." The first few months I was in sort of in shock. And one day I went down to visit my friends in Statesboro, and I said, I was depressed. And I said, "I feel separated from God." And that is the most horrible feeling in the world, to feel that separation from God. And I realized, after we talked and shared, that God had surrounded me with all of your love. It was His love coming through you all. And it was time for assembly, fall assembly, and we were electing a new delegate. And I thought, "Oh, God, you know I'm in no mental condition to be delegate and represent South Carolina." And I prayed and prayed and prayed about it. And I talked to the children about it, and they said, "Oh, Mom, go for it. It may be, if you get elected, it'll keep you out of the nursing home for 3 years." So I allowed God to lead me one more time. And I talked to him that morning, and I said, "I will do what you want me to do." And I got elected. I bargained a little bit with him. I said, "If I don't get elected on the first go around, I'm going to withdraw." But he knew I was kidding, because, see, my God has this terrific sense of humor. If he didn't, you know, I wouldn't feel loved by him, because I have a weird sense of humor myself. And I got elected, and it was the best thing I ever did, best decision I ever made to stand and to represent South Carolina at World Service. What a blessing. You know, I never dreamed how much work went into what Al-Anon does. You never dreamed how every word is scrutinized before it goes into that literature. The vastness of the translation of the material, the literature in the other languages. It was just such a wonderful experience. And to meet people from all over the country, I was overwhelmed with gratitude for having stayed in service work and having had an opportunity to serve that way. I continued to stay in service work. Right now I'm the treasurer of my group, And I think they're trying to teach me some responsibility because I'm terrible with money. But I'm working on it, okay? I'm being as good as I can with it. I did learn to stand on my own two feet. I did become happy, joyous, and free. But you know what I realized when the grieving, when the first part of the grieving was so severe, I realized I didn't do it by myself. I had some help. That I had to grieve everything I had never grieved before. You know, I think there comes a time that you have a loss of such magnitude that you don't have any choice. You have two choices. You either grieve or you die. I believe that with all my heart. I had not grieved my mother's death. I had not grieved my father's tragic death. And now all of a sudden, this was so great that I was forced to look at everything I had to stuff down. And back to the steps again. Because I never finish working my steps. I work them every day. On a daily, sometimes every minute. I became independent, and I started healing. And about a year after my husband died, my youngest son was in a terrible accident, and not such a terrible accident, but it was enough to hurt him. And the doctor gave him pain pills, and he had been real angry about his father's death. And unable to grieve it, and he relapsed on pain medicine. And he came to me one day. He wasn't living with me, so I just thought he was nuts. And he came to me one day and said, "Mom, I need help. I need to go to treatment center." So he asked me, could he go to Willing Way? And I took him. And that's been 4.5 years, I guess. He's still sober. He's working a wonderful program, and 2 years, 3 years ago, he got married, and 2 years ago, August the 19th, he had a son, and I already have one grandson who just graduated from high school and is on his way to Clemson, and here comes this other beautiful little baby to bring us so much joy. Of course, he acts and looks like his grandfather, and which is scary. Father says he acts and looks like his other grandfather, which apparently is scary too. They're both deceased, but he has brought so much joy in our lives. And you know, when all of this was happening, I didn't realize that I probably had put up some walls, and I didn't want to get close enough to, I felt safe with you, but I didn't want to get close enough to another person outside of this program that, or anybody, a male anyway, that I would have feelings for. And so that wall got a little thicker and a little higher. And people would say, you know, okay, it's time for you to start going out with somebody. And I still felt married. And nobody ever asked me anyway. I think the men in AA were afraid to ask me. And so about a year ago, an old friend of mine, whom I was pinned to 50 years ago, just sort of came back into my life again. And I've had a real hard time letting those walls down. And letting him in. He's my best friend. And I've allowed that much anyway. And he's with me today. His name is Bill. He's the other Bill B. And he's sitting in the back. But he's a very special person. He asked me not to do that. He asked me not to do that. So I didn't promise, though. I didn't promise. I wish that I could let you know how I feel in my heart about this program and what it's done for me and what it's done for others. I wish I could let you know how much I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been fortunate enough since I retired to work in a treatment center where I really get involved with brand new alcoholics who come to us with everything stripped away, and all you see is the pain, the fear, and I see them as loving, wonderful people. I have so many children in AA, and God has allowed me to be there in time in their lives that is so special to them. And I don't understand the disease of alcoholism. I know a lot about it, and I've experienced a lot, but I don't understand it. But I do understand that alcoholics are loving, warm, wonderful people. And I understand that that they're sick people and not bad people. And if I can be there, if I can hold out my hand, and I think I have a responsibility to do that to either Al-Anon or a suffering alcoholic, then I want to be there. And I can't imagine what my life would be like if I didn't attend Al-Anon on a regular basis. And if I didn't work this program to the best of my ability every day, I cannot imagine. I can't imagine how empty my life would be if I didn't have meet you all and see your faces. You know, I just feel so blessed. I feel so grateful that God's given me an opportunity to talk to people and share my message. It's just wonderful. I've been to Texas 3 times this year, and I've almost become a Texan. I fell in love with those alcoholics down in West Texas, and I went to Brownwood in the spring, and it's just wonderful. I am so blessed. I am God's child, and He is my Heavenly Father. Thank you very much.